now on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton is our producer this morning. The release of the police video, the beating and subsequent death of Tyre Nichols. Last night, the video was released. There was a lot of media expectation, a lot of media hype about violence to be expected around America. But it's been, so far, a night of peaceful protest. I've not seen any reports of violence as of 6 o'clock this morning. Protesters did shut down an interstate bridge in Memphis for several hours, but it did remain peaceful. If you saw the video, it's horrific. It is a brutal beating of an unarmed man, a man that did not have a prior record. Five Memphis police officers, five African-American Memphis police officers. Tyre Nichols, of course, the victim, also African-American. There was a call throughout the afternoon yesterday for peaceful protest, and included in the calls for peaceful protest were Tyre Nichols' mother. And if you saw the video, you heard Tyre Nichols, as he was being beaten by the police officers, you heard him lying in the street, being attacked by the officers. You heard him yelling, "Mom." He was calling for his mother. If you saw the video, there was a traffic stop, and there was no prior real video of what happened to cause the traffic stop. All you saw, the first thing you saw, was a police officer pulling him out of the car and throwing him to the ground, which is not procedure. Virtually nothing that the Memphis police officers did that night was procedure. So he's taken out of the car and thrown on the ground, and there's pepper spray flying from one of the police officers. That pepper spray apparently hit some of the other police officers. So you've got chaos to begin with. They're beating him on the ground. He gets up and runs toward his home, and he's trying to get home, which is about a half a mile away. He's running for about 3 minutes, and another set of police officers catch him down the street, and then those other officers, the initial officers, come to that scene, and the beatings continue. So that's in essence what the videos show. And in the afternoon, Tyre Nichols' mother made this plea.
Really, I want to say, I've never seen the video, but what I've heard is very horrific, very horrific. And any of you who have children, please don't let them see it. I just want to ask for prayer for my family, for this whole community. Right. And I want to say to the five police officers that murdered my son, you also disgraced your own families when you did this. But you know what? I'm going to pray for you and your families, because at the end of the day, this shouldn't have happened.
No, that's right.
This just shouldn't have happened. And we want justice for my son.
She went on to ask for peaceful protest. You may have heard the voice next to her was Benjamin Crump, the prominent civil rights attorney. And here's what he had to say about protest yesterday afternoon.
What we want is the protesters to take the cue from Tyre Nichols and how he acted in that video. He remained peaceful and calm. That's what we all should do. But I do worry about the agitators, because you have them lurking at every corner.
And C.J. Davis is the Memphis police chief, and here's her opinion on whether the police should have been wearing riot gear last night. This is in preparation yesterday afternoon, the Memphis police chief.
it's not smart for police agencies to deploy, you know, officers with riot gear and all of the bells and whistles, you know, in front of individuals. If we have community members that are peacefully protesting, we plan to allow them to have their space to do that and not to agitate them.
And again, to summarize, as of this morning, peaceful protest in cities around the country, but no reports of any violence. Also yesterday, you may have seen the release of the video of the attack on Paul Pelosi, the husband of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. And if you did not see that attack, it pretty much corroborates all of the police reporting and what we've heard in the media primarily. That was pretty much corroborated. If you see the video, you will see as the door opens, Paul Pelosi standing next to the suspect, but the suspect has his hand grabbing Paul Pelosi's arm. So he's holding Paul Pelosi's arm. Pelosi has a hand on the hammer at the same time the suspect does. The door opens. It happens very quickly. The police are trying to sort out what's going on because it was somewhat of a cryptic 911 call. So it happens very quickly, and the suspect just takes the hammer and hits Pelosi. It's off the video cam. You can't quite see where he struck him, but you will see he raises the hammer and begins to strike Paul Pelosi. There were a lot of questions of, you know, how did it happen that the police didn't do anything more to prevent the attack, and what were the circumstances, and where was Pelosi standing, and why? All of those questions, but it's pretty much clear and clarifies a lot of those questions in that video. But again, a very brutal video of the attack on Paul Pelosi. It is 6:17. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL, and we have a lot to cover this morning. We'll be talking with Jim Trusty, our legal expert, get his opinions on some of the cases that are going on. Also, we have got Jennifer Harper coming up, the Washington Times, some very interesting poll numbers that might even surprise you. John Gizzi's on the way, and he is our chief White House correspondent at Newsmax.com. We'll talk with John about the RNC meetings out in California, where Ronna McDaniel has retained her position as the head of the Republican National Committee. The politics of documents. We're going to talk a lot about that this morning. And also coming up next, we'll get some of the activity on the Hill this week, some of the fireworks from Capitol Hill. Cheryl Atkinson's coming up, very interesting story on Twitter and on COVID-19 vaccines. We'll talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. We'll get his read on the latest on Ukraine. And KT McFarland will be with us and kind of sum it all up. It's all coming up on the Saturday Morning Update, but right now, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Virginia on the Beltway, looked at the cameras, lanes are clear both on the inner loop and on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, you're not tapping the brakes in either direction, eastbound or westbound. 95 in Virginia, it's at speed between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, both northbound and southbound. In D.C., on 395 westbound, you're going to find an accident right shoulder right near Main Avenue. On 295 and on 695, lanes are clear. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
For today, we're looking for a high temperature of 53 degrees in the sunshine. For tomorrow, we've got a 40% chance of rain, high 50. Monday looks sunny with a high of 57. And Tuesday, 50-50 chance of rain with a high of 45. 34 in the nation's capital. It's 6:19 on the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler, and documents, and more documents. You know, we had Mar-a-Lago, and then, of course, Joe Biden brought us Car-a-Lago, and Mike Pence has sort of brought us nothing-a-Lago because he's really taken the high road on all this. And we'll get to the former vice president in a moment or so. But the fireworks in the White House briefing room, you've seen these for the past couple of weeks where they're kind of stonewalling. And it started out this week with Peter Ducey and Corinne Jean-Pierre. This was Monday.
Is President Biden involved in a cover-up?
The president has been very clear that he takes this very seriously. You asked me kind of a question that everybody laughed at, which was an interesting question to ask, but any other underlying questions that you may have, I would refer you to my colleagues, the White House counsel. I'm going to continue to be prudent. I'm going to continue to be consistent and refer you to any questions you have there.
Okay, so pretty much the dodge. Stephen Portnoy, formerly of WMAL, now at CBS News, White House correspondent. Stephen asked Corinne Jean-Pierre about the Pence documents, and here's what she said.
One of the things that the Pence team seems to have done in the last week is make public disclosure of the circumstance. Advise NARA, but also advise Congress, and now the public. Any reflections among the communications of press staff here as to how the Pence team handled it versus how...
Steve, I understand your question and I hear it. We've answered your question in many different variations. I don't have anything else to share from here.
That's been the same story for the past 2 or 3 weeks at the White House from Corinne Jean-Pierre. So moving right along, Democratic senators are not circling the wagons. Now, you know, of course, you've seen Chris Coons. You might have seen the Delaware senator. You know, he is the chief apologist for former Vice President Biden, his longtime friend, now president, of course. Chris Coons, of course, the apologist in chief. But not all Democrats are apologizing for the president. This is Maryland Senator Ben Cardin when asked about classified documents.
I'm not certain how, because I never taken classified documents outside of our SCIF, so I don't know that. We need total transparency. I can't wait to see how this investigation unfolds.
Of course, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin has always towed the party line, but not towing the Biden line this week.
I can't understand how any individual senator can take possession of a classified document, let alone remove it to another location. It's just unthinkable.
And then we got another comment from Dick Durbin at another time this week.
I will tell you, when it comes to members of Congress and classified documents, we go through an elaborate, careful process even to read one of these pieces of paper. And the thought of keeping them on our desk to get around to later or taking them home or out of the office is unthinkable at this level.
And as you know, if you've been following the story, there's sort of two situations here. You have Joe Biden when he was a senator. And as a senator or a congressman, you have to view these documents in a SCIF, you know, the secure location in the Capitol. You can't take a document out of there. But they did ask John Kirby about those SCIFs and the security of the SCIFs.
How hard is it to walk out of a SCIF with classified material?
Everybody who goes into a SCIF knows what the requirements are to go in. And knows what the requirements are to go out.
Now, you know, the funny thing, and I haven't heard anybody say this, maybe somebody has, I haven't heard it anywhere, got to thinking about it. So Biden's a senator and taking documents out of the SCIF, and they end up at his home in Wilmington. How did Biden get home to Wilmington every day for the past how many years before he was president and vice president? How did he get home when he was a senator? He took Amtrak every day. So there's Joe Biden schlepping top secret documents, obviously on an Amtrak train, because that's how he commuted. You know how close people sit next to you on Amtrak trains? If I was sitting next to Joe Biden on an Amtrak train, don't you think I'd have maybe glancing every few minutes over there to see what he was reading, see what that stack of papers was? What happens if he got up and went to the restroom and he's got top secret documents stuffed in the briefcase? How many did he maybe leave on the train? Because sometimes he's a little absent-minded. Anyway, speculation on my part, nothing more than speculation, but add it up. The guy's a senator. He takes these things out of the SCIF. How did he get home? On the train. Oh, boy. Well, they've been asking and asking and asking to find out what was in the documents. And the DOJ and the White House ain't talking. And Congressman Jim Jordan is not happy about it.
Not only should the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee be able to get a damage assessment, they should be able to see the documents, for goodness sake. And the idea that the executive branch is saying, no, you can't do that, and the DOJ is saying you can't see those, I think makes no sense.
So that is Jim Jordan. A lot of comments from the Republicans this week. And, you know, of course, the media is asking everybody questions all the time, all over the place. Tom Cotton was asked about it at a press conference on the Hill.
Well, solution to this, the administration should stop stonewalling the Congress and provide these documents to us.
What about the former vice president?
Which agency is it?
Well, obviously, it comes from the top because the president is accountable or is responsible for the entire executive branch. So whatever bureaucratic disputes are happening behind the scenes, it's the president who has the decision to say, provide these documents to Congress. Members of Congress in both parties, in both chambers, are saying Congress should have it to conduct our legitimate oversight, which in no way interferes with an investigation by either special counsel into either President Trump or President Biden.
So you want to see all the documents?
Did the director actually say that?
I'm not going to characterize what the director of National Intelligence said or anything else that was discussed in a classified setting.
The DNI.
But I will say Congress should have these documents and be able to review them. There's a longstanding precedent for this. It happened under President Trump. It happened, for instance, during Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation process when we reviewed highly sensitive FBI documents. It happened on occasion under President Clinton. There's no reason why Congress cannot review these documents in a secure, classified setting so we can make an assessment about what damage it may have caused to national security, if any.
So that's the controversy now, is what's in the documents. 6:27, we're going to take a quick break, and then back with Speaker McCarthy on Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell. You got to hear this. It's next. Stay with us. Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us this morning. And a lot of controversy this week over House Speaker Kevin McCarthy kicking Eric Swalwell and Adam Schiff off of the House Intelligence Committee. And it's created a firestorm among the Democrats. And the reporters were getting kind of testy with Kevin McCarthy, and he laid the law down and explained why, number one, he kicked Adam Schiff off the committee.
You just raised a question. I'm going to be very clear with you. The Intel Committee is different. You know why? Because what happens in the Intel Committee, you don't know. What happens in the Intel Committee, although the secrets are going on in the world, other members of Congress don't know. What did Adam Schiff do as the chairman of the Intel Committee? What Adam Schiff did, use his power as a chairman and lie to the American public. Even the Inspector General said it. But I will not be like Democrats and play politics with thieves, where they removed Republicans from committees and all committees. So yes, he can serve on a committee, but he will not serve on Intel, because it goes to the national security of America. And I will always put them first, all right? And if you want to talk about Swalwell, let's talk about Swalwell, because you have not had the briefing that I had. I had the briefing and Nancy Pelosi had the briefing from the FBI. The FBI never came before this Congress to tell the leadership of this Congress that Eric Swalwell had a problem with a Chinese spy until he served on Intel. So it wasn't just us who were concerned about it. The FBI was concerned about putting a member of Congress on the Intel Committee that has the rights to see things that others don't because of his knowledge and relationship with a Chinese spy. But you know what? Those voters elected Schiff, even though he lied. Those voters elected Swalwell, even though he lied to the American public, too. So you know what? I'll respect his voters, too, and they'll serve on committees, but they will not serve on a place that has national security relevance because integrity matters to me. That's the answer to your question.
So he took no prisoners in that response, and that gives you a sense of some of the fireworks on Capitol Hill this week. 6:31, time for a check of the traffic and weather. LBD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Virginia, Interloop of the Beltway, there is a crash. Two right lanes are blocked in McLean, right at the George Washington Parkway, exit 43. Outer loop of the Beltway in Virginia, you're at the posted speed limit. Maryland side of the Beltway, no issues in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. In Montgomery County on 270, go ahead and set your cruise control. Lanes are wide open between the Beltway and Frederick. In Prince George's County, if you're traveling between the two Beltways, either on the BW Parkway or 95, I don't have any reports of anything in the road slowing you down northbound or southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Tracking that Saturday forecast, a chilly start, temperatures in the 30s, but we quickly jump into the 40s around 8 o'clock. Lunchtime, we're looking at 50 degrees, and this afternoon, expect 55 to 56 for an afternoon high. Combined with sunshine and some light winds, a beautiful Saturday afternoon. Tomorrow, we're looking at clouds to start and rain showers for your afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
34 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:32, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It is the Saturday morning update. It is always good to have you join us. It's always great to have Jennifer Harper join us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Rick.
Well, you know, the Republicans are, what, 2 weeks into it, and the poll numbers are starting to come out, and they've been looking at Democrats running the Congress for a while. How are Americans feeling about elected officials in general?
Oh, boy. Funny you should ask. Well, good morning. Let's have a poll right out of the gate here. Anyway, Americans in general are just totally looking askance at their politicians at the moment. And, of course, there are numbers. And this is coming from Issues and Insights. They are do a regular poll with the TIP poll. And this is what they have to say. Washington, you have a problem. And elected officials should take note. Regardless of party affiliation, those who elected you no longer have faith in the idea that you actually represent them. That came from Terry Jones. He's an editor over there at Issues and Insights, an interesting news organization. But they joined up with the TIP poll, and they conducted a survey of registered voters on this phenomenon of people going, I don't like my elected officials anymore. And here's what they found. Two-thirds, even 66%, said that elected officials represent mostly the views and values of their big donors, not average Americans. Just 16% said they felt that their elected officials represented their constituents, and another 18% said they weren't sure. And then moving right along, the TIP poll also asked a closely related question reflecting how people felt about their own representatives in Washington, meaning who is actually representing them in D.C. How satisfied are you that your congressional representative represents your views and values? That was the question they were asked. And once again, Rick, voters were just not happy here. Only 39% of Americans said they were satisfied with their congressional representative, while 52% said they were not satisfied. Again, this is a Issues and Insights TIP poll of 1,107 registered U.S. voters conducted January 4 through 6. So that's where they stand right now.
Well, in contrast, there are some Republican governors who seem to be getting things done. And as you look at the numbers, what are you seeing?
Well, I paid a lot of attention to these numbers because they really reflect an old-fashioned know-how. Remember that phrase? Oh, do you have know-how? Well, the Republicans definitely seem to have know-how right now. And, you know, I thought the GOP is kind of a grand old party when they get in this mode. And the people that are getting in this mode are the GOP governors. They have an economic knack, Rick, in no uncertain terms. And the Republican National Committee has done a lot of research on this. This is coming from Tommy Piggott. He's the Rapid Response Director for the RNC. He says, at this point, it's so obvious it almost feels like old news. Republican economic policies work. Case in point, 13 out of the top 15 states with the lowest unemployment rates are led by Republican governors. Let's have a round of applause for that, Rick. Anyway, moving right along. In addition, he says 9 of the top 10 states with the highest percentage of jobs recovered since the pandemic began are led by Republican governors. And this research, it's based totally on U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, by the way. And the numbers speak volumes, really, about which political party really does it better as far as these practical, productive economic practices go. And Mr. Piggott advises Republican governors have built economic engines even in the face of massive inflationary headwinds from President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats. If you want an economy that works for you, vote Republican. Gee, that sounds like a great motto to me. But anyway, that's your Republican governors for this morning.
All right. You're always looking at different surveys and research and things. A major pollster is the one to come up with an estimate on how many immigrants want to cross the southern border. What you got there?
Oh, boy, this is a real eye-opener, mainly because it's coming from Jim Clifton. He is chairman of the Gallup poll. That's definitely, you know, longtime global pollster. Everybody looks to Gallup for all kinds of things. And he just went through some numbers. Here's what he says. During the 2022 fiscal year, the U.S. Border Patrol apprehended nearly 2.4 million migrants who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border illegally, shattering the previous year's record high. The questions U.S. leaders should be able to answer, regardless of their politics, how many more people from Latin America would be coming to the southern U.S. border? You know, it makes sense to kind of think ahead here. So he looked at some of the math. This is what he said. This is, again, coming from Jim Clifton, chairman of Gallup. He says, roughly 466 million adults live in the countries that make up Latin America and the Caribbean. Gallup has interviewed residents in these countries each year for the past 16 years, asking adults if they would like to move to another country permanently if they could. In 2022, 30% said yes. He says, this means roughly 140 million Latin Americans would like to move permanently to another country if they could. Gallup then asked them where they would like to move. And Mr. Clifton goes on to say, of those who want to leave their country permanently, 33% or 46 million said they want to move to the United States. Seekers of citizenship or asylum are watching to determine exactly what and how is the best time to make their move. What exactly is U.S. leadership's message to them? 300 plus million U.S. citizens are wondering, and so are 46 million Latin Americans. Again, that's coming from Jim Clifton, chairman of Gallup, out of interesting numbers.
Well, we all know the Small Business Administration is a federal resource for small business, but there's another set of initials that I'm a little surprised about.
Yes, indeed, and those initials are DOD. This is a very big buyer, and they are looking for small suppliers. Got some information from the Department of Defense, and they have released their small business strategy, which clearly promotes a, quote, strong, dynamic, and robust small business industrial base, says can be achieved by focusing on reducing barriers to entry. That's pretty simple. And anyway, they've kind of gone over this, and according to Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks in a written statement, she said, from manufacturers providing the critical parts that we need for our arsenal to technology companies developing innovative systems and capabilities, small businesses are vital along the entire spectrum of the department's needs. And I like this question, this quote from her in particular. She says, reducing barriers and creating more opportunities for small businesses will allow us to expand, innovate, and diversify, increasing our warfighter advantage. Like that warfighter advantage part there. So if you know someone who is kind of thinking, how do I get in on the DOD stuff? Well, they have just issued a guide to marketing to DOD. Very interesting. Went to see it myself. If you're curious, it's a very easy web address here. business.defense.gov. Again, that's business.defense.gov. And kudos to the DOD for reaching out.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, Washington Times. Follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. We're at 641 in time for check of the traffic and weather. We've got Al BD in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In D.C., 295, 395, and 695. All three, all the lanes are clear. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, no issues in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County on the inner loop or on the outer loop. But on the Virginia side of the Beltway, inner loop, you're going to find a crash. Two right lanes are blocked in McLean right after GW Parkway. On 66 in Virginia, no issues on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Tracking that Saturday forecast, a chilly start, temperatures in the 30s, but we quickly jump into the 40s around 8 o'clock. Lunchtime, we're looking at 50 degrees, and this afternoon, expect 55 to 56 for an afternoon high. Combined with sunshine and some light winds, a beautiful Saturday afternoon. Tomorrow, we're looking at clouds to start and rain showers for your afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
34 degrees in the nation's capital, 642, the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is a Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trustee joins us. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at the IFRA law firm here in Washington and the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
As we have talked with you over the past weeks, we always like to check in and see what the developments are in the Mar-a-Lago document investigation. Obviously, one of the big developments this week was the announcement by former Vice President Mike Pence that indeed there were classified documents found at his residence. But what is the latest as far as things go on the Mar-a-Lago investigation?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of stuff that's happening behind the scenes as usual, but I think the biggest thing that we're looking at is an interview of the general counsel from NARA, the National Archives and Records Administration. It's coming up in front of the House Oversight Committee on Tuesday afternoon. And from our perspective, that can be really a huge moment because NARA, from what we see, is an institution that has been very biased in their approach toward President Trump. And we really want to hear them explain themselves. How can they make a criminal referral for the first time in history for something that's not even a crime in the first place? What was their role in denying a SCIF, a secure location for document review, to President Trump? And as we talked about before, how do they explain this 2018 Obama Foundation letter that gives NARA $3.3 million to move documents that have still never apparently moved from Illinois? I mean, I could come up with probably dozens of questions that I hope the committee will end up asking general counsel for NARA. So from where we sit, this is kind of a big day to see what types of answers are given that reflect either incompetence or bias or both on behalf of the entity that basically got the ball rolling with this criminalized NARA document dispute with President Trump.
Want to turn to the breaking news from last night. Of course, the release of the video of the beating of Tyree Nichols by five African-American officers. Tyree is African-American. One thing that comes to mind is emotion. And the emotions of Tyree, the emotions of the officers at the time, the emotions of the community, the emotions of the leaders of the country over the past few days, the things they've said, and the emotions in the media and how that impacts all of our emotions.
Now, Rick, I think emotions are a very appropriate thing to bring up in this context. And look, if you watch the portions of the video that were released last night and try to string together some sort of sequence of events, it's very difficult not to have an emotional reaction. I mean, I've been around law enforcement, criminal justice, autopsies, everything you can think of, including very graphic crime, for probably 33 years now. And I might have a little different approach than a lot of people would have when they see something like this kind of video or these types of videos. But I think that emotions typically are at odds with justice. I mean, we like to think that justice is this kind of intellectual pursuit that leads to a good result. And we recognize there's a lot of emotionality that ties into crime. But at these early stages, at a day like today, you know, the morning after the release of these videos, what we really need as a society, if we want the system to work, if we want people to respect criminal justice, is we need leaders to step up and rise above emotions. I mean, that's literally what you need from leadership is some intellect, some compassion, but not succumbing to the emotions of the moment, not going with kind of the emotional tide for political purposes. And I think that's forever a problem with these high-profile police incidents. It's just too easy for politicians all the way to the highest level in our country to just tap into that emotion for the wrong reason, to basically say, ha, here's another example of evil police and look how destructive they are, instead of recognizing that in some ways, as horrible as the situation is, it's the beginning of the criminal justice system. We need to see if the system is going to work. I actually still have faith based on some of the high-profile videotape-related trials we've had over these last few years that justice can work in this country, that 12 citizens can look at these types of videos and make reasonable decisions and come to just verdicts if given the chance to do it. But there's a lot of people out there that want to milk the emotion for political gain or for their own destructive purposes or because they have some sort of anti-cop, anti-establishment sentiment. And that's the kind of thing that responsible politicians should be leading us all away from right now.
Jim, we've talked a lot about the Alex Murdaugh case in Georgia, and that is now at trial. And if you could give a quick refresher for people who have heard the name Alex Murdaugh but not remember specifically kind of the key details of the case, and then your perspective on what happened this week.
Sure. Well, this is this prominent family in the Low Country of South Carolina. The Murdaughs have actually held the post of the chief prosecutor for one of these neighboring counties for 175 years, I believe it is, for generations. This has been kind of the legal titans of the Low Country. Alex, at one point, was in fact the solicitor, which is the chief prosecutor in that territory. But Alex started having a lot of problems, some of which involving taking money from his law firm, his son Paul being involved in a homicide while intoxicated driving a boat, at least charged with that. And then came the horrific murders of Mrs. Murdaugh and son Paul, 22 years old, who were killed on the property of the Murdaugh family in very graphic and horrific circumstances, for which Alex claimed that he had an alibi. Well, the alibi began to unravel like almost everything else in Alex's life, and he was charged with murder, started the trial this week. Opening statements happened midweek, and it's a real interesting case. I mean, we knew that going in, but the circumstantial evidence is going to be the key. There's not going to be direct evidence of witnesses that saw the shooting of the wife and son, but you're going to hear things such as the fact that moments before the shooting takes place, Paul was recording a cell phone video of some of the family dogs on this piece of property. And at that time, apparently, you can hear Alex's voice on the video. Well, that's critical because the central premise of Alex's guilt is that he falsely tried to establish an alibi of taking care of his ailing father hours away at the time of the murder. So if you have a false alibi as a prosecutor, if you can prove that it's a false alibi, that tends to stick pretty heavily in the craw of jurors. They wonder why in the world would anyone create a false alibi if they weren't directly involved. They have evidence that he had a gunshot residue on a blue raincoat of his, that one of the two 30 caliber blackout rifles has gone missing since that shooting, and forensic technology and autopsies show that the wife was killed by that exact weapon. There were no defensive wounds, according to the prosecutor in opening statement, which would tend to show, and I think this is a very light assertion, but would tend to show that they were disarmed by the person that shot them. In other words, they weren't immediately concerned about some sort of violence coming from the family father. And the government's going to rely heavily on the fact that what they call a perfect storm of events were taking place, that he was stealing settlement money that stemmed from his housekeeper's untimely death at the property, that he had stolen millions of dollars from the law firm, and this now disgraced, disbarred attorney was losing it. The opening statement for the defense, of course, focused on reasonable doubt and said there's no direct evidence, and that really this is a case where they've thrown together disparate parts, different circumstances, and a desperate attempt to pin these murders on the family father. The testimony this week is just barely into the case, but they had an officer that came out to the scene that said Alex immediately tried to suggest that the murders must have happened as some sort of follow-up on threats that Paul, the son, had received for this horrible boating accident where he killed his girlfriend. It was on the pier at the time he was piloting the boat. Odd kind of moment for the father to jump immediately to that explanation. And the officer noted that the father never seemed to cry, even though he was seeing this hideously graphic scene of the mother and son having been executed by gunfire. So, Rick, what's going to happen over the course of the next week or two is the jury's going to sift through circumstantial evidence. They're going to decide whether there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Alex essentially executed his own family. But when you really think about it, what they're doing deep down is they're looking over at this man for their entire experience in the courtroom and deciding whether or not he's a monster, whether he is literally capable of blasting a shotgun into his son's face and killing his wife with this 30 caliber rifle. So it's going to be very challenging for the prosecution. It's going to be an interesting trial. I think that the evidence is pretty strong, but you just don't know how this is going to play out. You know, this is a dynasty kind of family at trial with what would seem to be an almost motiveless murder of what should be loved ones. So this thing could cut either way. It's definitely worth watching. And it's all about whether the circumstantial evidence reaches that crescendo where a jury is comfortable convicting him.
Jim, another case that we followed pretty closely is that of a firebombing of a police car in New York City during the 2020 BLM protests. The lawyer was convicted. And an interesting note from the judge, who said that boarding school Princeton, a law degree from New York University, should have rendered the suspect a peacekeeper, not an instigator. And that's just one of the comments from the judge, but put the whole thing in perspective for us.
Well, yeah, this is an interesting case, and it was, again, a highly emotional time across the country. But I actually think that the big story is not even as much how the judge struggled to issue the sentence for Mr. Mattis, the male part of this couple that threw the Molotov cocktail. You know, the real story was differential treatment by the Department of Justice. And the judge certainly agonized and recognized that there were fairly privileged lifestyles that these two had led, and they were successful lifestyles in terms of becoming lawyers that were generally kind of left-wing advocate-type lawyers. But the media, I think, has really lionized these two as being almost civil rights figures for throwing a Molotov cocktail into an unoccupied police cruiser. I don't think that's a fair way to look at them at all, and I think this judge kind of agonized as to how much imprisonment was going to be appropriate before giving a sentence of 1 year and 1 day to Mr. Mattis. And by the way, for your listeners, you might hear of that sentence from time to time in the federal system, a year and a day. And I know a lot of people say, why 366 days? What's the significance there? Well, actually, if a person gets sentenced to a year and a day in the federal system, they will do less time than a person who gets a year. And the reason why is the federal rules for good time credits don't kick in until you exceed 1 year. So all that to say, if I got sentenced tomorrow to 1 year in federal prison, I would serve almost every day of that. If I got sentenced to a year and a day with the credits that the system gives, which is not parole, but at least some good time credits, I can expect to serve something more like about 8 months. And in recent years, with some of the changes due to COVID, the First Step Act, there's a chance you can even get less than that on certain types of crimes in the federal system. So a year and a day is actually a pretty defendant-friendly way of issuing a sentence. But again, the story here was DOJ. The story was that under the Trump administration, the prosecutors that handled this case set up a plea agreement and actually executed a plea in court where these defendants pled guilty to 10-year felonies with the likelihood, or at least the possibility, of a terrorism enhancement driving their sentencing guidelines up towards that 10-year number. And in fact, when they pled guilty, knowing that was what they were facing, the probation offices did what they did, a pre-sentence investigation. They looked into all of the facts. They said this enhancement applies, and they said the guidelines call for a 10-year sentence. Well, enter the new prosecution thoughts. The federal prosecutors start looking from a different perspective, from a Joe Biden administration perspective. They think that it's too harsh to contemplate a possible 10-year sentence. So they undo the plea agreement and let the parties execute a new plea. And I can tell you from being around the federal system for 18 years, this doesn't happen often. This is like Halley's Comet in terms of how often you see that kind of change to a plea agreement. They came in with a 5-year charge, meaning they could never face more than 5 years, no terrorism enhancement, and a guarantee that the government was only going to ask for 18 to 24 months, which was well below the sentencing guideline range. All of that is a cue to the judge that it's okay to go way under the sentencing guidelines that normally give you an expected sentence in a case like this. And the judge gave Mr. Mattis a sentence even below that recommendation and talked about how the New York bar needed these types of attorneys to be part of their rank and file. I really question that. But the bottom line is there were some sympathies based on kind of the emotions of the moment and the backgrounds of these individuals being largely good. But I have to say that the message of giving Molotov cocktail users 15 months or a year and a day in this case is not the greatest message. And I think the underlying message from DOJ is they're willing to be very political in their approach to certain defendants' cases, like the left-wing activists, compared to perhaps right-wing activists that shouldn't expect any sort of break like that.
Jim Trusty, appreciate the perspectives. He's a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much.
Sure, thanks. Have a good weekend.
And you too. It is 6:57, Saturday morning update, 7 o'clock news next. Back with John Gizzi, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, Cheryl Atkinson, and K.T. McFarland with everything you always wanted to know about handling classified documents from a former Deputy National Security Advisor. Stay with us.